May I ask the speakers to come to the floor here? We have a good 20 minutes. I thought it was a very interesting session. Usually when you look at the individual names, you don't see connections here. But I think I clearly see a connection here. The session could be called the main challenges in nephrology and kidney disease, taken from very different angles, you know, cardiovascular, the change of cardiovascular events, some of the definitions for outcomes in trials, and the huge problem of infection in patients with chronic kidney disease and dialysis. And lastly, you know, if everything is all clear, the implementation of that with all the challenges were tackled by Vivek during his talk. So let's get started with Vivek and some of this. Wanted to expand a little bit the discussion about the new models for renal replacement therapy, taking that affordable dialysis system developed by Vincent in his machine. How do you see the challenges when it comes to implementation related to training and implementing PD in low resource settings from a safety perspective?
Thanks, Roberto. I think it's going to take a lot just to make sure that the technological solution, when it is developed, gets to be used in the system. So, these solutions are not just related to technology, but are related really to the entire healthcare system. And it will require governments and policymakers to commit themselves to seeing this through. But also, as you say, great challenges related to healthcare workforce development. How will it be implemented, especially in remote rural areas of the various parts of the developing world? And so some of the challenges were foreseen and included in the prize. For example, it shouldn't depend on regular supply of electricity, so use of solar power and things like that. But again, we do know that solar power is also not necessarily available around the year in all parts of the world, so I can already see some challenges there. And I think for those who don't know about it, which I suspect is the majority of us, this solution that Vince is developing is aimed at developing, is procuring pure water, which will allow us to develop a peritoneal dialysis solution, which can be developed and packed locally and used locally as well. But training people in appropriate use of peritoneal dialysis in remote areas where there could be challenges related to hygiene, there could be challenges related to implementation of how to perform peritoneal dialysis exchanges safely, do present us with problems which will need to actually, as people who work in a particular healthcare system, have to identify and develop. And so it's really important for these clinical trials to be done in real third world setting where these solutions are to be implemented, rather than to be done in some idealized first world situation where a number of these solutions are already available. So I can see that there are two aspects of it. One is to show the performance, that it does what it is supposed to do, and the second is implementation, which has to be done in a real-world setting. So I don't want to romanticize the solution that it will immediately solve the problem of access to dialysis. But then this is the very first step, that at least there is a technological solution available, and that how this technological solution is to be implemented in a real-world setting is for us, all of us, to discuss and solve.
Thank you. Wolfgang, a couple of persons were actually interested about the calciphylaxis effects of warfarin and how it would interfere in some of the results that you've seen, since it's, the relationship between this and the outcomes captured in those studies are not probably very easy to capture.
Yeah, it's an outstanding question, anonymous question askers. Clearly I wish I've had, another 20 or more minutes to cover that very important aspect of the anticoagulation story. When we try to explain the low use of warfarin in this population, part of this may be, you know, nihilism. Part of it may be absence of evidence, so people don't feel supported in their treatment decisions. But certainly, there's the story that has really been brought to the forefront, not the least by Sagar Nikwekar and Ravi Tadani, who were here, I believe, earlier, that there's vitamin K mediated pathways, first of all, regarding calciphylax, but also with regards to vascular calcification more broadly. And, you know, as you consider any treatment decisions when it comes to oral anticoagulation, this is a component that you certainly need to keep in mind. You know, calciphylaxis is a catastrophic outcome for patients affected by it. Very difficult to treat, very little evidence, high mortality, and certainly something that where patient preferences should weigh in considerably. You know, other aspects certainly for these decisions, if I may add, is also anticoagulation nephropathy, where, you know, Brodsky and colleagues at The Ohio State University have shown first for vitamin K antagonists that there is an increase in declining kidney function in patients orally anticoagulated with warfarin, and that was explained in the mouse model and later in humans that it's bleedings, glomerular bleeds that apparently, you know, then lead to a decline of glomerular mass and therefore kidney function. It has since been replicated also for NOACs or DOACs, but it seems to be much worse for warfarin. So I think these are all very, very important considerations to have. I'm hoping that this answered the question specifically that you asked.
Thank you. Vincent, there's someone interested about the dynamics of the license through biofilms and if this could be useful also in catheters, for instance, catheter-related infections.
Yes, actually, a license destroy biofilms completely. Basically, if you think about it, and we take electron micrographs and microscopy of a biofilm after being treated with license, what happens is it's slowly degraded. What happens is that the bacteria are part of the matrix of the biofilm, because a biofilm is bacteria, carbohydrate, and DNA. And as the bacteria are exploding and degrading, it just completely collapses the biofilm. As opposed to treating with antibiotic doesn't really destroy the organism. It's still part of the matrix, so it becomes more difficult to get an antibiotic through that matrix. But the lysin is just completely destroying it. It takes it right down to the bottom, and it's gone.
Very interesting. Stephen?
The second part of that question was, could it be attached to a catheter?
We've tried to immobilize it. We've done where we've taken the lumen of a catheter that has a biofilm on it and cleansed, put a lock, run lysin through that catheter and remove the biofilm completely from the catheter. So you could keep the catheters in longer because you can remove the matrix of the biofilm in that catheter. But to immobilize it on the surface of a catheter, so far it hasn't worked. We may need longer extensions to try to get it to work, but those are things we're trying to engineer.
Stephen, you didn't approach the potential use of some of these renal protection strategies in the ESKD population. So the question was, would you recommend or would you support the idea of using ACEs or ARBs or other strategies also in the dialysis patient who has some residual renal function?
That's a completely different question. I mean, we don't have great data for RAS antagonism in dialysis patients, except there's some, I think, in PD that you can preserve residual renal function longer. And there's the data from spironolactone use in dialysis patients that the initial study, I remember, had a huge effect size, almost unrealistic, a 70% reduction in mortality. But so... Yeah. Oh.
Yep. Yeah, there is some interesting data on the use of ACEs or ARBs for the preservation of the membrane function, but also RCTs for ARBs and for ACEs in PD, but not on HEMO, as far as I know, and the impact seems to be quite similar in both populations.
I think we first need to start, you know, understanding how to reliably measure residual kidney function in dialysis patients.
Yeah.
You know, I think we greatly struggle doing just that very simple task. Yeah. And once we've solved that, then we can maybe look at, you know, impact of treatments on it.
Good point. Vivek, you're going to...
Yeah, just ask a follow-up question to Dr. Coca. I think your presentation was extremely persuasive. But do you think that there is any point at which the risk-benefit profile starts to become adverse? So far as, you know, this hemodynamic change that we see initially with the use of various interventions that lead to a fall in GFR.
So you're saying if you're seeing a patient and then their GFR continues to fall more than a 20% decline? Yeah, of course, on an individual basis, then you should be thinking, you know, that's probably more than the hemodynamic event. Then you have to start thinking, do they have bilateral renal artery stenosis or, you know, severe aortic stenosis, something else that's going on that, you know, is really contributing to this decline, or another nephrotoxin, or, you know, evaluate the patient clinically. But I'm saying, by and large, on an intention-to-treat basis, from a trialist perspective, that we cannot employ these creatinine endpoints in isolation. And we really have to think about it contextually, because I showed over and over that there's effect modification depending on how that serum creatinine rise was generated. But surely, I'm not saying if someone's progressively declining, yes, then of course stop. There's something else.
That's interesting. Well, Wolfgang, there's a question about the, you know, the issue of anticoagulants interfering the vascular access. I mean, is that something that we'll need some more studies on? What's the effect of these interventions in fistulas and grafts?
You know, I don't think that the evidence taken as a whole is particularly strong, although it's stronger than much in nephrology. You know, there were at least some trials, not necessarily with anticoagulants only, but also with clopidogrel, for example, with aspirin. You know, rather than giving you a guesstimate answer, I would refer to the upcoming KDOQI guidelines on vascular access in dialysis, which I believe are coming out like every day now. So Charmaine Locke from the University of Toronto has co-chaired this initiative, and I believe they will have some very specific recommendations on that. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Vivek, one question here is about transplant first in this scenario. What is your idea about how to incorporate transplant in all the strategies for RRT?
I think clearly from the point of view of cost effectiveness and from the point of view of its very transformative nature, transplantation in suitable candidates is something that we must all strive to so that they can get them. But I think we all know that for a variety of reasons, getting transplantation is, to all of those who need it and those who are suitable for it, is not going to be possible. And moving away from this very strict cost, you know, cost-benefit economic kind of analysis, we do know that for a variety of reasons, dialysis has now become established as a treatment modality everywhere in the world, including in places where it's difficult for it to be afforded. So I think what we need to discuss as a community is to find what is the right balance here. No question that any country that wants to start dialysis should first set up a transplantation service so that, just as, for example, South Africa has done. In South Africa, people who are eligible to get state-funded dialysis must be candidates for transplant candidates. And if a kidney becomes available to them, they have to accept it. Otherwise, they cannot stay on dialysis. So they have made that policy, which seems quite sensible, in fact. But, you know, that obviously leaves a large number of people who are not candidates for transplantation out of this framework of providing dialysis. So how do we solve that? I think it is for individual societies to actually discuss these issues and come up with appropriate answers. But to the fact that should transplantation be available in the mix? Absolutely, yes. Should transplantation be prioritized? Yes. Do countries do it? No. As I showed you, including my own country, government has announced this policy of providing dialysis to everyone, irrespective of the level of income. But they haven't done this for transplantation, which would seem to be the logical thing to do. Yeah. But it doesn't happen. And I think this has a lot to do with how government policies are made, what are the different pressures that are borne to bear on governments. Because the other issue of this is also this big push about around development of public-private partnership for care delivery, in, not only in kidney disease field, but in all fields. But what these governments need to do is, if basically they want to take care of the worst off, that these facilities should be made available in public sector organizations.
It's so difficult, right? Because in some countries, even culture or religious beliefs might actually interfere on how transplant could be applicable. So really understanding the local reality and accepting that there is no size fits all is the kidney care challenge. And I think ISN is doing a great job trying to identify the local reality and provide support on how to approach that.
Yeah, and there are some ways in which you can address these issues. For example, in a country like Japan where brain death is not easily accepted, they have actually developed a large program of retrieving organs after cardiac death. Yeah. So I think there are solutions, but culturally appropriate solutions must be found.
One last question to Wolfgang. So are there differences in the stages of CKD in terms of atrial fibrillation, PD, hemo, and transplant? Meaning, what's the continuum there?
You mean the prevalence?
For atrial fibrillation, prevalence, and...
Yeah, I mean, so the incidence and the prevalence go up with advanced kidney disease and is higher in those patients on dialysis. The prevalence does go up, especially in dialysis patients. It goes up, what was it, by like 11 or 15% over the course of a decade. Interestingly, it's not only the incidence, but it's predominantly the duration of survival after incident atrial fibrillation that increases over time. Which potentially has two explanations. One is that we do a better job in treating these patients. I'm slightly skeptical about that. I think we might identify them a little bit earlier. You know, and identifying atrial fibrillation and dialysis only is not rocket science. It doesn't exactly require a monitor. You know, you just have a look into the blood chamber for like 10 seconds and you know what's going on. So it's really not that difficult. It's about, you know, having this awareness among clinicians that this is a big clinical entity that has, you know, abysmal consequences for these patients and to try to do what you can to manage the situation. On PD, there's very little information. We have a paper in press. Is it out yet? I don't think so. That looked at the incidence of atrial fibrillation between PD and HD patients. Turns out that the incidence of atrial fibrillation in patients starting dialysis with hemodialysis is much higher. I want to say 50% higher in the first 90 days. So it's like the stress test, you know, patients start dialysis, they get on the thrice weekly thing, there's a stress test for your cardiovascular system that is not present when you start with peritoneal dialysis. But in the long run, there doesn't seem to be a difference. If anything, maybe slightly higher in PD patients, and I'm not sure I have a good explanation for that. But there are certainly differences. With regard to oral anticoagulation, on PD, for example, the data are absolutely absent. You know, we tried to tackle this way back at Stanford 6-7 years ago. There were just not enough patients, not enough outcomes since 2006, which when, you know, the Part D benefits started coming along. We started looking at this again, and, you know, if we have something to say and to find, then we'll let you know.
Thank you. Well, I think we... okay, one question from the floor, Martin.
Yeah, that works. I have a question about the license. You showed that you have a rapid explosion of these bacteria. So in vivo, what would be the consequence of that? You have bacterial content, toxins, bacterial toxins. So what would you expect to see in a patient when you give the license in a MRSA infection?
So the question was, you know, when you explode the bacteria from a what's the impact on the patient in terms of release of endotoxin and things?
Yeah, that's a good question. What Actually, the amount of enzyme that we're using therapeutically does not completely destroy the organism. So what we're really doing is punching a couple of holes in the organism and the cytoplasm ejects. If we were cutting them up into small pieces, then the cell wall is highly inflammatory and would cause a problem. But it's not what's happening. You check the cytokines in animals that are treated with lysine and those that are treated with penicillin, it's very much the same. So if we use too much enzyme, then the fragments of cell wall could be highly inflammatory, but we're not seeing that. In fact, in the patients, we see no adverse events in any of the patients that were treated.
I think it was a fantastic session. We are right on top of the hour, ready for coffee break. I would like to thank our speakers for the lectures, for keeping on time so it all for the nice discussion at the end, and thank the audience for the attention. I think we get back here at 11.